As Gordon just said, I'm not a historian, but I am very interested in church history. I have been a member of Christchurch since 1968 and have been active in a number of ways over the years. Sidesman, reader, prayer, warden, parish councillor, synod rep, treasurer, secretary, auditor. I'm not doing any of those at the moment. You'll excuse me, I'm going to read a lot of it. In the early years of the settlement of the Illawarra district, there was only one recognised church in New South Wales, the Church of England, whose ministers were attached to the detachments of soldiers in the different districts and were called chaplains. It was not until 1826 that any soldiers were sent to the Illawarra, when a small detachment was sent to Wollongong, and not until 1831 that any were sent to Kiama. Even then, a chaplain was not appointed to the district until 1833. Before this date, however, the Reverend Thomas Kendall, who was interested in the cedar trade in the district, had baptised several children and conducted burial services. In 1827, he purchased Barul, a 500-acre property south of Kiama, from Andrew Byrne. The stone wall, which marked part of the boundaries of Barul, can still be seen on Lemon Grown Estate. The Reverend Kendall also performed at least one wedding, and that was of his son, Thomas Surfleet Kendall, whom he married to Caroline Blake Rutter at Gerringong in 1829. Then, on the 30th of May, 1831, he baptised their daughter Jane at Barul. The chaplain appointed in 1833 was the Reverend Wilkinson, and his enormous parish covered the area from Wollongong to south of the Shoal Haven. His itinerant ministry continued until 1836, when he was succeeded by the Reverend M.D. Mears and later by the Reverend P.T. Beamish, who was the last to cover this vast area. These itinerant ministers were stationed at Wollongong, and it was there, and it was the Reverend Mr. Mears who in 1842 applied for a grant of land to be used as the site of the church in Kiama. The site chosen was on the southeast corner of Bong Bong and Manning Streets, and little time appears to have been lost in commencing the erection of a church. For it was reported in the Sydney Morning Herald of June 13, 1843, that a church was in course of erection at Kiama, and when the statistical returns for 1843 were published, they showed that a church was in existence in Kiama at the end of the year, which would hold 125 persons and had an average attendance of 70. This was the first church of England in Kiama, and indeed was the first building erected in town for divine worship. Up to 1848, Kiama was still in a very raw state. Nothing had been done to clear the streets or to provide shipping facilities, and a visitor to the area at the time reported there were only 17 or 18 houses, two inns, two stores, a small jetty or wharf, and a wooden church. And of course, the church was the first one for the Anglicans. However, rapid progress was made during 1848, and from then onwards, the population of the district more than doubled in 2 years. In fact, a Sydney Morning Herald of that time reports that on one farm, 250 acres, no less than 70 persons were obtaining a living, although a great part of the farm was still uncleared. By 1856, the population of the little township was 495. The Kiama parish was made a separate parish in 1850, and the first minister was the Reverend J. Barnier, M.A., later D.D., who was appointed on the 11th of February of that year. This smaller parish contained Jamberoo, Shell Harbour, Kiama, Gerringong, Shoalhaven, and Jervis Bay as far south as Sussex Inlet. During Mr. Barnier's ministry, the congregation at Kiama determined to erect a permanent building in place of the wooden one in Bong Bong Street, and to erect it on a more suitable site, away from the sound of the surf. The site was secured on what is now called Church Point, and in 1856 arrangements were made for the building of Christchurch. According to the records of the Royal Australian Historical Society, the foundation stone was laid on 17th of June 1856. The building, like so many others erected in the district at that time, was of blue metal rubble, most of which was given by Joseph Pike and was taken from his property. The interior walls were plastered in imitation cut stone, and after the building had been completed, the first heavy storm demonstrated the necessity of plastering the outside wall also. By the way, you can still see on that wall, on the north wall, some of those indentations, but several courses of painting over the years have filled in those, and then they don't stand out. The interior walls were plastered in imitation cut stone after the building had been completed. The first heavy storm demonstrated the necessity of plastering outside wall also. This work was carried out by T. Galvin and Son of Wollongong, and they apparently did such a good job, for the foundation stone, one of the church, has never been seen since. The builder, by the way, of the church was not known to us for a long time. It's only a few years ago that we found out who it was. The builder was a Scotsman who came out to Sydney, and he was a stonemason by trade, and he did the work. His name was Robert Carnell. He came here in 1856 and finished the job in 1858. He went on then to build the Anglican Church in Raymond Terrace, and that took him from 1861 to 1862. By the way, we don't know who the architect was, but we believe it was copied from some of the plans that Edmund Blackett provided. There was no evidence that Blackett ever came here, but certainly his plans would have been circulated. The church was completed at the end of 1858 and was opened and consecrated. Normally, you don't get a consecration at the same time as it's opened, because most buildings have not been fully paid up. But apparently, this place was built, and there was no money owing when it was opened, so the bishop was able to consecrate it as well as open it. That was done by Bishop Barker, Bishop of Sydney, on the 13th of January 1859. This original building was minus the tower, ceiling, and gallery, and contained not a pipe organ, but a harmonium. Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Surfleet Kendall supplied the trimmings for the reading desk and the communion table. Unfortunately, Mr. Barnier did not see the church completed during his incumbency. While building operations were still in progress, he was transferred from Kiama, being replaced by the Reverend Foster Ashwin. The exact date of erection of the gallery cannot be verified, but apparently it was added not long after the building of the church. The gallery is mentioned in an original manuscript made available by the Mitchell Library. This is the memo book, Kiama, of the Reverend T. Sharp, who spent 5 weeks in the district in August-September 1869. He refers to the church in the following words: Christchurch, a neat structure with nave, chancel and organ gallery, is situated near the sea, and the roaring of the waves during a storm is tremendous. The unique and very beautiful ceiling, made of cedar, with its graceful arched timbers, which is a feature of the church, was added in 1872. The unusual design has the appearance of an inverted hull of a ship, but apparently there is no foundation for the story, so often repeated, that it was designed with that purpose in mind. In December 1880, tenders were called for the erection of a Sunday school hall, and the foundation stone was laid on the 15th of June 1881. The ceremonial stone was a block of freestone set on the northwest angle, and the ceremony was performed by Miss Charlotte Pike, daughter of Joseph Pike. The Kiama Independent of the 17th of June 1881 says that the official record of triactions was read by Mr. R. Kendall. The record was written on parchment, and together with the papers and the Church of England record, was placed in a glass vessel in the freestone under the foundation stone. And by the way, we don't know where that is nowadays. And we thought we might be able to find it, because when the development across the way of the halls was done, the foundations were all uncovered. And many of us looked over a period of a fortnight trying to find that stone. We didn't find it. The hall at the time, by the way, it was open, was very small, 15 foot by 20 feet. It was officially opened on the 30th of November of that same year, 1881, and the cost of building, plus its furnishings, was £250. Miss Charlotte Pike, that I just mentioned, who laid the foundation stone of the Sunday School Hall, lost her life in a boating accident at the mouth of the Minamara River on Boxing Day 1893, in company with her sister Elizabeth Honey, two brother-in-laws, Captain Thomas Honey and Mr. George Wood, and a nephew and two nieces, the children of Mr. Wood. Before you go out this afternoon from here to go over to the other building, look at the windows, the two last ones on the southern side, and also the one up behind the staircase to the gallery. That they commemorate that drowning. The year 1893 saw the planting of the Norfolk Island pines, which now tower above the church. They were planted by Mr. W. Gray. In 1896, tenders were called for the erection of a five-bedroom cottage and outbuildings to serve as a parsonage. That's what they call the minister's residence in those days. And in this building this building was completed in 1897 at a cost of £700. It was later enlarged using money paid in the government by the government for resumption of some of the church property. I'll come back to that in a moment. When the church was first opened in 1859, the choir was located straight opposite the doorway. However, about 10 years later, it was removed to the gallery, which was actually built to accommodate the choir because of the crowded congregation in the nave of the church. For some reason, perhaps because congregations were smaller, the choir was moved downstairs again, this time to the front of the church, and there it remained until just a few years ago when this was written. It hasn't been used for a choir for ages. The pipe organ, built by E. Ladegast, was placed in the church in 1914, and an entry in the minute book recording a meeting in May of that year tells that it was moved that Miss Swindles be authorised to play the new pipe organ and to keep the key of that organ. Miss Swindles had been an organist at the church since 1899. In 1922, the erection of the Soldiers' Memorial Tower was commenced. Its massive shape harmonising well with the design of the church. The entrance that you came in is part of that tower, and on its walls are set commemorative tablets. The final cost of the tower was more than double the original estimate. Yet it was free of debt a very short time after its erection, a tribute to the generosity of the parishioners and the diligence of the town and tower committee. In 1939, a special feature was made of the 80th anniversary of the church, and a brochure giving the history of the church was compiled by the rector of that time, Reverend J.W.A. Watkinson, and the church wardens. It is interesting to note that the church wardens, John Weir, Oswald Honey, and Arthur Gray, all bore names which have been associated with Christchurch and Kiama since its earliest days. In the 20 years since these many additions and improvements have been made to the church, some as memorials, some as gifts from individual parishioners or from committee attached to the church. Another world war had been fought during that period, and many young people of the church joined the various services. In this district, several CMF detachments and an Air Force radar station were operated, and in 1942, the Sunday School Hall was established as a welfare centre for these men. During this time, the HMAS Kiama, a newly commissioned corvette, paid a visit to Kiama Harbour during her shakedown cruise. Her crew members were entertained at this welfare hut and became departing, and before departing were presented with an electric urn for use on board. Some years later, just prior to being paid off, the little ship returned to Kiama and her captain presented to the church the flag which has been carried by the ship throughout the war services, and that's where it is now. You won't see it, Margaret, but you know about it, don't you? Perhaps the most important event of this latter period has been the erection of the memorial gates and fence with their commemorative plaques. They were opened and dedicated by the late Archbishop Mull on the 19th of November 1949. The parish of Kiama, after Jamboree became a parish of its own, was responsible for the churches in Gerragong, Fox Ground, Crawley Forest, Bombo, and later Minnamurra. Now the only daughter church is Minnamurra. Chirrungong is now a parish, and Crawley Forest, Bombo, and Fox Ground do not exist, the last being burnt down. When the 1859 church site was selected, it was the site of the Protestant graveyard, and there were graves, many which have no headstones, and there is no record of exact sites or names of the interned. This site had a frontage to Terralong Street to the east, a frontage to Berule Street, The site had a frontage to Terralong Street, and to the east a frontage to Berule Street. It backed onto property in Bong Bong Street, and to the west backed onto property in Manning Street. This was a very large site. In 1896, the Lands Department resumed some of the land fronting Berule Street to enlarge the showground. The money given by the government for this purchase enabled the parish to enlarge the rectory, that is, the one that was pulled down in 2015. The site on the southeast corner of Bong Bong and Manning Street was retained by the parish, and weatherboard cottages were built to house the workers. Some of the cottages were removed, and the land added to the showground at the Chidick Oval end. And the last was sold in 1956 to Caltex for a service station. This is the site where Dr. Moss's surgery is now. The money from this sale enabled a centenary hall to be built, which was opened in 1961. The organ to be relocated, and a remembrance wall constructed. That's the one just out here on the south of the church. In 1969, JC's preschool used the centenary hall, resulted in building a large storage area for the preschool gear, and more importantly, a new block with flush toilets for general use. After the preschool moved to its new site on the corner of Bland Street and Childhaven Street, the rector's wife organised playgroup, which used the centenary hall and the storage area. More recently, in the year 2000, a special committee was set up called the Christchurch Kiama Conservation Fund, which is a fund owned by the National Trust of Australia and New South Wales and Christchurch Kiama. It was set up in 2000 by the wardens at that time to provide funds for the restoration and conservation of the 1859 Heritage Building and to provide availability of tax deductions for donations to this fund. No major works have been done, no major works have been funded for the Heritage Building from the parish until 2015, when the cost of Section B of the new dam course and sealant was shared by the parish and the fund. Money has been given to the Conservation Fund as a result of appeals, generous donations by a significant number of donors, and by a payment of a fee for weddings, and that's currently $200. Since its conception, just over 111,302 dollars. That's been spent on major works. Money was provided for a new roof. We haven't got a slate new roof, but it looks like one because it's a a grey ceramic tile. The external walls were restored, and internal and external wall painting amounting to $40,000 was paid. Later, $17,300 and $14,000 from a New South Wales government grant was spent on the restoration of the organ. Also, $5,443 was paid for underground drainage to rectify some rising damp problems. More recently, $16,659 was spent for repairs to the stained glass windows and for the external plate glass and brass mesh for protection to the windows. In 214, Section A of the new dam course and desalination cost $19,140, and restoration painting of the necessary internal walls cost another $4,570. In 2015, Section B of the dam course, the Conservation Fund paid $7,500 and the parish paid the balance. In 2016, rather, it is hoped that Section C, the final stage, will be done with Conservation Fund and parish sharing the cost. In December 2012, a youth shed was opened for use initially to be used for meetings and morning teas, whilst the halls, kitchen, offices and toilets were built and opened for use in August 2013. This was a wonderful endeavour. And when you go over for afternoon tea, you'll notice the old hall can still be seen, identified, as well as the Centenary Hall. With permission for storage of archives, crying room, baby feeding, meeting room and foyer, and the cost was completed in November 2015 due to the most generous request from a former parishioner. Thank you very much. Yes, that's right.
If you've got any questions, you might have to speak up a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, just one thing, Mr. Smith. On the southern side, we have a problem area, but we also have some graveyards. Who's the oldest person in the graveyard here on the southern side?
You probably know that, Richard. I don't. No.
Our gentleman from the first fleet.
Yeah. I thought you were talking about the columbarium wall.
Oh, no, no, no. I'm talking about...
I know that. Yeah. I'll just read something about that. I thought I might have been talking too long, so I left that bit out. And if anyone hasn't walked around the ground, the small graveyard, all that's left of it, we don't know how big it was, but no record of Christchurch would be complete without mentioning the little burial ground which lies on the southern side of the church. Over the years, many people have wondered if the graves were there before the church was built or if they were moved there later from some other site. Records of the Mitchell Library state that the surveyor Sharks wrote to the Surveyor General on the 16th of July 1831, drawing attention to the fact that five bodies had been interred at Kiama. Also, an early plan of Kiama shows that burials had been made at two different spots, one just west of the pilot's house and the other near the present Anglican church, where, of course, the bodies still lie. Perhaps the presence of these graves was the determining factor in choosing the site of Christchurch. Unfortunately, most of the inscriptions on the tombstones have weathered away and can no longer be read, but perhaps the most interesting one of all is still like illegible. It reads, Mr. John Gowan, who died April 28, 1837, aged 74 years. He arrived in the colony in the First Fleet. Strangers, friends, and here you see the sad truth of mortality. Let each one ask himself, am I prepared? Should I be called to die? It's believed that John Gowan never lived in Kaimata. But I actually taught some people that were related to that. They used to live in Bland Street. I don't think they live there now. Yes, he's related.
And some relatives to your uncle.
Yeah. That's why we've got... He got... You know where Barul is?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that was his house. And Kendall's Beach. And Kendall... What else have we got? I don't know much about the Kendall history himself.
One of the very
early photos
of the pilot's cottage shows...
No, I'm not aware of it. Some of the members of the Historical Society might be able to tell you that. Mr. Whalen, do you know?
The transmitting car, I'm not aware of. I think it's probably put up for World War II and taken down by the army as far as the power that was in the bar station. So it was probably taken down after the war. That's, I don't think there's anything to do with it.
I know a bit more about Kendall. He actually went to New Zealand with Marsden. You know that too, don't you? That's down Milton Way. No.
When
Gordon said that I was a former archivist, most of the archives are just mostly registers of births, deaths and marriages and meetings, minutes of meetings and all that sort of thing. I haven't caught all that, David. You'll have to excuse me. I don't hear very well. So I missed most of that.
Oh, sorry, Keith.
He asked me later at morning, at afternoon tea.
Keith, thanks very much for that. I'm the great grandson of Joseph Pike. This church has a lot of privilege for us.
Yeah.
And we still use it.
Yeah.
And we still come in and visit the memorial windows
of
relatives. And I thank you for bringing that along.
At one stage in my career here, I used to get regularly to the 7:30 at night service and drive two of the girls, Pikes, up to the approach.
Minnie and Flossie Pike.
Yeah.
Lived on Pikes too.
Yeah. We could make another thing about that. These are lovely windows, and the chap that did all the repair work has his plant in Mossvale, because it's about halfway between Mossvale's about halfway between Canberra and Sydney, where he does most of his work. But he came down here. And he reckons we've got windows here that are priceless. So if we had to pay for their insurance, our insurance is paid by the diocese, and they probably doesn't cover the value of this place at all. This is a history in itself, and especially so many of the old names that came up, like Grey and Honey and so on. We've got King there, Grey, Pike. So before you go over to afternoon tea, I suggest you look especially at the wood at windows, and if you like, look around the other ones. The only one that has nothing to do with parishioners is these two up here.
Such a long period, and as our members realise, we've had